the headlines, Iran's president slams the U.S. government for hindering Tehran's efforts to purchase COVID-19 vaccines from foreign countries. Myanmar's security forces reportedly clash with anti-coup demonstrators at a northwestern town, killing at least 11 people. And India registers yet another record high of daily coronavirus cases, reporting nearly 127,000 new cases in 24 hours. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story, Iran's president Hassan Rouhani has criticized Washington for hampering Tehran's efforts to purchase COVID-19 vaccines from foreign countries. Rouhani said U.S. sanctions have complicated Iran's access to millions of doses of vaccines from foreign pharmaceutical firms. The Iranian president slammed the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump for preventing the entry of drugs and medical equipment to Iran during the pandemic. He said Trump waged an all-out war on Iran through his pressure campaign. However, Rouhani stressed that all anti-Iran policies have failed, and that even the new U.S. administration has acknowledged their failure. Rouhani hailed the domestic efforts to produce coronavirus vaccines, calling the vaccination a priority of his government. Political analyst Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh says U.S. economic sanctions against Iran are nothing but blatant violations of human rights, especially during a pandemic.
It was during President Trump that vaccine was actually beginning to distribute it, but it was actually President Biden who banned it from the Iranians and even other countries. We know that even Canada and Mexico, which are the first neighbors to the Americans, did not receive the vaccines, the Pfizer vaccines that we were supposed to receive, and then they were given actually the AstraZeneca or the J.J. Johnson & Johnson, which is about 65% efficient. And they didn't even distribute the vaccine to the Europeans, who are supposedly their allies. The point is that the Americans, first of all, are working very, very arrogantly in this regard. And when it comes to Iran, it is not only arrogantly, it is also hostile. Even when the coronavirus pandemic began, the Americans prevented Iran from access to the loan that it wanted to receive. They prevented Iran from access to buy the test kits and such things that were vital at the beginning of the pandemic. So it's not just a technical issue, it's not just a some political issue. It is a blatant human rights violation, and it is some inhuman act by the United States.
More details have emerged about an attack that targeted an Iranian vessel in the Red Sea 2 days ago. A staff of the civilian ship called Savis said an unidentified helicopter carried out a patrol around the ship a day before the incident. He added two unidentified speedboats were also seen near the vessel hours after the attack took place. Iranian ship was attacked on Tuesday morning off the coast of Djibouti. The attack caused minor damage to the ship. Investigations are underway to find the perpetrators. Iran has condemned the attack, calling it a violation of international law and maritime regulations. Tehran says the vessel was stationed in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden to secure the region against pirates. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, has hailed a U.S. decision to resume funding for the body. UNRWA Commissioner Philippe Lazzarini said the U.S. move came at a critical moment while Palestinians are struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic. Earlier, the Palestinian premier welcomed the renewal of assistance to the U.N. agency. Mohammed Shataya also urged U.S. President Joe Biden to take additional steps to advance Palestinian rights. But Israel's U.N. envoy condemned Washington's decision, claiming UNRWA is engaged in political advocacy.
I have expressed my disappointment and objection to the decision to renew UNRWA's funding without first ensuring that certain reforms, including stopping the incitement and removing anti-Semitic content from its educational curriculum, are carried out. UNRWA is an organization that engaged in political advocacy and enables incitement to violence. Therefore, it should not exist in its current form.
The reactions came after Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. would provide $150 million in humanitarian assistance to the U.N. agency. The former U.S. administration blocked nearly all aid to Palestinians in 2018, which included cutting assistance to UNRWA. The body provides food assistance as well as health and education services to millions of Palestinian refugees. University professor Saad Nimr says UNRWA has focused its efforts on providing services to refugees, and it has not been engaged in any political activity since its establishment in 1949.
But apparently that the UNRWA, once it was established in 1949, till now it's confined its work only to provide services including the education and health and administering the camps, all in all around seven services that they are provided to the Palestinian refugees. None of them is a political one, nor the UNRWA had ever played any role in saying that the Palestinians have the right to return back to their homes. They are confining themselves only to services which in the first place, United Nations created Israel and the plight of the Palestinian refugees. Now we are talking about more than 6 million Palestinian refugees all over the region. They should also do something for this plight. No country in the surrounding countries of Palestine, such as in Jordan or in Syria or in Lebanon, are able to take care of those refugees.
Israeli politics is once again dealing with a major development as President Reuven Rivlin has mandated Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to form a cabinet, albeit reluctantly. But will Netanyahu be able to form a cabinet this time around after multiple efforts failed to produce any results? And more importantly, will this make any difference in the lives of Palestinians?
The Israeli politics is back to a square one. Israel's President Reuven Rivlin has once again given Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a mandate to form a government following an inconclusive election on March 23rd. Under the Israeli law, Netanyahu will have 28 days with the possibility of a two-week extension to form a cabinet. If he fails to do that, Rivlin will pick another candidate or ask Parliament to choose one. Netanyahu, who is Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, in power consecutively since 2009, now faces a tough task of breaking an unprecedented political stalemate and enlisting allies for a government coalition. He has so far failed to secure enough pledges of allegiance from smaller parties, which would be essential to forming a majority cabinet.
Well, right now it looks like he has about 59 seats and he needs 61 for a majority, so he is in a quandary. And the only choice he has is quite ironic, and that is the Ra'am party, which is an Islamist party that is composed mainly of Bedouins who live in the Negev, which has four seats, and that would give him the 61 that he needs. However, he has some far-right Judeo-fascist parties in that coalition that will not want to have anything to do with anything that has the word Arab in it. So he really has a very narrow path here.
Israel's election held on March 23rd, its fourth in 2 years, ended with neither Netanyahu and his right-wing political party Likud nor a prospective alliance of his opponents managing to secure the majority of parliamentary seats. Many believe that the elections in Israel have now turned into a circus, with Israelis headed for a fifth election in 2 years.
Well, Israel is in a total dysfunctional state right now. As you said, if Netanyahu fails to form a government and his opposition, Yair Lapid, fails to form a government, we do go to a fifth set of elections. And it should be said that during these periods when there's no functioning government, really Israel comes almost to a standstill. And we saw, even though some people are saying that Israel did well during the COVID pandemic, it really failed in very fundamental ways, and there were at least 6,000 Israelis died from COVID because of the dysfunction of the government. So it's really an astonishing situation you have right now, and even if Netanyahu does form a government, it will be the first time that an Israeli leader will form a government who is under, not only under indictment for criminal corruption charges, but on trial for them.
Netanyahu's mandate to form a cabinet comes as he's dealing with graft charges. That aside, what will his possible success mean for Palestinians who have for years fallen victim to his crimes in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip? During the Netanyahu era, it is recorded that over 3,500 Palestinians have been killed.
The Israeli president's pick to form a cabinet is on trial on corruption charges. The hearings entered their second day earlier this week in a courthouse in Jerusalem al-Quds. This as a 71-year-old prime minister is now popularly referred to as a crime minister for a string of wrongdoings. Netanyahu denies all charges and says prosecutors are trying to undermine the voters' will and overthrow him. To shift attention away from his graft charges, the premier has been trying in recent months to publicize a vaccination campaign against COVID-19 with the hope of securing more public support. But protests against Netanyahu and his cabinet have been held in Israeli cities for months, with demonstrators demanding their resignation over corruption. But as long as the Palestinians are concerned, the election of Netanyahu or anybody else wouldn't make much difference. This as one of the candidates during a previous election was boasting about how many Palestinians were killed under his watch, that is Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz.
I don't think that the election will offer anything positive for the Palestinians. There are some murmurings in Washington, D.C. that the Biden administration wants to improve relations with the Palestinians and that maybe it wants to resume negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, and that is a hopeless proposition as far as I'm concerned. But Biden doesn't have the ability to attract the Palestinians to negotiate, and the Palestinians will unfortunately have to continue to eke out a survival, and they themselves have elections coming up, which should prove very interesting depending on what the result is. But the Palestinians shouldn't hope for much from the Israeli elections.
This especially comes into light as the premier has kept millions of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade for years. Although Palestinians do not have a hand in changing the Israeli leadership, the Israelis who can know that they're dealing with a leader who has the blood of thousands of Palestinians on his hand, and maybe that's why he's not a popular leader to be able to form a cabinet. What is certain is that Palestinians won't be better off no matter who takes the helm in Israel.
Elsewhere, nearly a dozen more anti-coup protesters have been killed and several others injured in clashes with security forces in northwestern Myanmar. Local media say troops opened fire at demonstrators protesting against the military junta in the town of Tazi. Protesters also fought back with hunting rifles and firebombs. The Southeast Asian country has been in chaos since February after the military ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi over alleged voter fraud in the November elections. The junta has intensified its crackdown on anti-coup protesters. Despite international outcry, a monitoring group says more than 550 people have been killed in Myanmar's protests. India breaks the record of its single-day coronavirus cases with nearly 127,000 new infections as the world's second most populous nation is grappling with the second wave of the pandemic. India's overall caseload has now reached close to 13 million, the highest after the U.S. and Brazil. India's death toll is also nearing 167,000. The government has already imposed new curbs in several states, including the hardest hit Maharashtra. Officials blame the surge on gatherings and people's reluctance to wear masks. Elsewhere in Asia, South Korea has reported its highest daily infection count since early January, with 700 new cases. Most of the new cases were reported in the Seoul metropolitan area. The government has said it's weighing new restrictions and is expected to announce new social distancing rules on Friday. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith says South Korea is going to suspend the rollout of a coronavirus vaccine as certain problems have been reported with this drug.
There's other issues also coming out, other news coming out today, that they're going to suspend the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine pending a review by that vaccine from the European Medical association. It's been associated with some blood clots. There have been some cases here, I believe three cases of blood clotting here in South Korea. So there are concerns here that South Korea will not reach its goal of herd immunity by November. There have been, you know, reports of sort of a lack of vigilance. It's something that I've observed when I go out into public, that people's behavior over time has changed. It's now been more than a year since we've been practicing these social distancing measures around the world and here in South Korea as well as elsewhere. People are getting really tired of it and kind of dropping their guard. And the government is saying that that's what's led to these increases in cases.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on European countries, just like it is wreaking havoc in the rest of the world. Poland reported 954 new deaths, bringing its total fatalities from COVID-19 to well over 56,000. The country also registered around 28,000 new infections, pushing the caseload to around 2.5 million. In Russia, 365 new daily deaths were officially reported, which takes the overall fatalities to nearly 102,000. New cases also rose there by 8,600 to over 4.6 million. In Germany, the number of confirmed cases rose by more than 20,000 to nearly 3 million. There were also 306 new fatalities, bringing the overall death tally to 77,700. The COVID crisis continues to pile woes on Italy's economy. Almost half of the Italian businesses are at risk of shutting down permanently, according to the National Statistical Agency. Max Sheely reports from Rome.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Takeout food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This is chemical warfare that you are not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras, right on the streets, in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964. Yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, it on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also, that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them, of any military in the world, for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. So the way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add
to that? I think what also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black community.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. The cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
An endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief break now from the discussion. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to you know, I mean, everywhere. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on, and people are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, has said, "Fair acts prevent evil deaths from happening. Every fair act is alms. The people of fairness here are the people of fairness in the hereafter. The people of the abominable acts here are the people of the abominable acts in the hereafter. The people of the fair acts will be the first to enter paradise. The people of the abominable acts will be the first to enter the fire."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find a great many conversations, a great many golden and beautiful dialogues between the divinely appointed imams of the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam and their companions, their friends, and the people in general. Even these conversations might seem to just be conversations. We learn a so very much great deal from these conversations. We learn beautiful words of advice. We learn beautiful pearls of wisdom from these conversations, these dialogues. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam, had ample opportunity to be able to have these conversations relatively freely and with ease due to the historical time in which he lived. So Imam al-Baqir, in certain conversations that he has with his companions, urges them to treat people according to the rules of social conduct which are found in Islam. In some of these conversations with his companions, Imam al-Baqir requests and summons the Muslims to fulfill the needs of their Muslim brothers and sisters. On many occasions, in these conversations, Imam al-Baqir warns the Muslims from leaving and casting aside, isolating and deprivating their Muslim brothers and sisters. Something, interestingly, which we find happening on a great and massive scale in today's world. Are not the people of Yemen dying? Are not the people of Syria in a dire condition? Are not the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran under undue sanctions? Are not the Rohingya Muslims being burned alive? Are not Muslim schoolgirls and schoolboys being kidnapped by terrorist organizations such as Boko Haram? Never ever should we leave the Muslims aside. Imam al-Baqir says in this conversation, if the servant refrains from helping his Muslim brother and does not strive to fulfill their need, they will be afflicted by a need themselves which will cause a sin and not a reward. Is this not what we see today in the world, dear brothers and sisters? Because we have decided to look the other way, we have decided to ignore the plight and the needs and the distress of our Muslim brothers and sisters. We have found ourselves going deeper and deeper into this hole of worldly desires and materialism and satanic wishes and aspirations. While we continue to live in prosperity, material prosperity, worldly prosperity, we continue to swim in money, we find that our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world are dying of starvation. And so our carelessness, our ignoring our Muslim brothers and sisters has caused us to go farther into sin. And so if we want to take ourselves out of this grave which we have dug, we must help our Muslim brothers and sisters across the world. Beautiful words of advice in this conversation by Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One very simple advice from the Imam that he gave to Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz is the only Umayyad Khalifa, is considered to be the most just. Sayyid Razi, you know, the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha, was a man of letters, expert in Arabic literature, and that was the focus when he compiled the sayings of Ali. And he was a very accomplished poet in his own right. He has two lines of poetry, and since he's a Sayyid, he's from Banu Hashim, he says that if the eyes of a Hashimi would ever share tears on a Umawi, it will be on Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. Because of his, you know, goodness and kindness towards the Ahlul Bayt. There were certain, you know, meetings between the fifth Imam and Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. In one of the meetings, when the Imam was now leaving the gathering, Umar ibn Abdul Aziz says, can you give me an advice before you leave? And Imam said a very short sentence, which is even for us, especially those who are in the position of power and authority, wherever they are, whether at home, in their office, in a community or the society or whatever, where he says, Usika bi taqwa Allah. Number one, I advise you to have the taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then he says, وَاتَّخِذَ الْكَبِيرُ أَبًا وَالصَّغِيرُ وَلَدًا وَالرَّجُلُ أَخًا. He says, then look at the person you are dealing with. If he is older than you, consider him like your father. If he is younger than you, consider him to be like your son. If he is same as your age, consider him to be your brother. If you start looking at people from that perspective, then your attitude will change. And that is where we will have peace and harmony. And I think we need here quite a lot. This is not for Umar ibn Abdul Aziz only. This is for each one of us. When we deal with one another, an elderly person is like the father, young ones are like our children, and those who are on the same age are like our brothers.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.